For the week of January 9th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 131, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And inside the devil, I'm Michael Giltz.
Oh, I see what you're doing there. You are making reference to this week's number one movie at the North American box office, The Devil Inside.
That's right. I should have known this movie was going to be a hit because I get my mail at a mailbox. It's Manhattan Mailbox is the name of the company. They're there to always sign for my packages and stuff. And I went there and one of the guys who works there goes to the movies. He's like in his mid-20s, early 20s. And on Friday, he said he and all his friends were going to go see The Devil Inside, which I had not even heard of. And I was like, The Devil Inside? I go, you know, it's going to be. We looked it up and it had horrible, horrible reviews. And he really wanted to see Mission Impossible. But all his friends were determined to go see The Devil Inside. And he doesn't go to a lot of movies. And How do you know this much about somebody who works? I'm there 3-4 days a week.
Oh,
he
okay.
borrows, you know, it's a tiny little place with four employees. He borrows money. He borrows movies online. I'm putting that in quotes. You know, he's a younger generation who doesn't think you should have to pay. So he's seen movies, but he doesn't always pay top dollar at the box office to go. So it's a little unusual when he goes. All his friends were going, like a gang of eight of them, to see The Devil Inside Friday night. Clearly, they were not alone.
Yeah, well, that is for sure. Now, we took a couple weeks off, Michael, so we have some news to catch up on. Happy New Year, by the way. A little belated. We're a week into the new year. But we took 2 weeks off, and a few things happened while we were away.
Yes, one or two. But the theater season, the end of the year list came out, and we have a roundup with Patrick Healy of the New York Times about all the top theater news of the year and some of his great articles that he did about theater on the road and why it's so important to Broadway.
That's right. I mean, you're constantly hearing us talk about that, about how, you know, only a small percentage of Broadway shows ever earn back their investment. And as you just said, Patrick Healy he's the theater news and feature reporter is his official title there at the New York Times.
He'll just raised their cover price to $250.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Yikes. Well, he'll be here to explain just what you said, how a lot of shows are making their money on the road in their national tour. First, though, we'll bring you up to speed on a little movie news as the year-end accolades continue to pour in. Things are looking up in the music industry, where sales actually rose last year. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop as we try and cram 3 weeks' worth of news into this show. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. The number one film at the North American box office was The Devil Inside, which was a very unusual hit, very much like Paranormal Activity. But here at Showbiz, we always tell you about the worldwide box office, because that's what really matters. Instead of focusing on just the ticket sales in Georgia, a lot of people look at the whole North America box office. We look at the entire world, and we got a lot of catching up to do. But let's run through the numbers, and then we'll talk about how these films have fared over the big holiday weekends. The number one film at the box office around the world is Sherlock Holmes' Game of Shadows, which has dethroned Mission Impossible after that was number one for 3 weeks. Sherlock Holmes' Game of Shadows grossed $57 million worldwide. It's at $334 million and counting, and closing in on the money made by the first Sherlock Holmes film.
Now, this, when it was released, was considered to be a bit of a disappointment, and yet...
No, not by us. It was released a week earlier in a slower week. It was not a disappointment whatsoever, and the numbers are proving us right about that.
That's right.
Number two at the box office is Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. It grossed $48 million worldwide. It's at $458 million and counting, and looks like it will meet or beat the grosses of the highest grossing film in this franchise so far. It should hit about $600 million worldwide.
And that highest grossing installment was Mission Impossible 2.
That's right. That was the John Woo film, right?
I believe so.
Number three is Alvin and the Chipmunks Chipwrecked. That grossed $40 million worldwide. That's at $240 million and counting. At number four, just from its totals in North America alone, is The Devil Inside, which grossed $34.5 million worldwide. It cost less than $1 million for the studio that picked it up. It made double what they paid for the film at the Thursday midnight screenings when it grossed $2 million. So they knew we were onto something very, very big. This is one of those, you know, crazy hits like Saw and Paranormal Activity, where a tiny micro-budget horror film has just made a ton of money.
Yeah, you know, I was on Twitter when the media screening let out, and apparently at the all media screening for this film, which is the screening where all the critics go to watch the film and then race home to review it, there was booing, like loud booing.
Well, I mean, it even has terrible reviews from audiences. If you look at CinemaScore, it has like an F. There are people who love it and give it an A, and there are just as many people who love and give it an F, but overall, it's down to an F score. Its rating on Rotten Tomatoes is terrible from everybody. Nobody who sees it actually likes it particularly. There are always somebody who's going to like everything, but the reviews have been pretty awful across the board. You should look for it to probably fall pretty hard next weekend, but you never know when it opens that big. It creates a curiosity factor, so we'll have to see how it does. And number five around the world is The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. That grossed $24 million worldwide. That's $105 million and counting. And number six is Puss in Boots. That grossed $18.8 million worldwide. That's at $457 million and counting. And number seven is The Adventures of Tintin, The Secret of the Unicorn. That grossed $12 million worldwide. Obviously, it's slowing down now. It's at $315 million and counting. And number eight is We Bought a Zoo, the Matt Damon film. It grossed $11 million. It's at $70 million worldwide and counting. At number nine, another Steven Spielberg film, just like Tintin. This is War Horse, which grossed $10 million worldwide. It's at $64 million and counting. And at number 10 is The Darkest Hour, the sci-fi flick, which opened on Christmas Day here in North America. It grossed $8.7 million. Then the number 11 is The Untouchables, the now controversial French comedy, which grossed another $6.8 million worldwide at a minimum. We don't have all the figures in yet. And it's at about $150 million worldwide and counting. And at number 12, very notable, is Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which expanded quite a bit in its market screenings in North America. It grossed $5.7 million in North America. I couldn't get UK figures, but it's now at about $10 million and counting. It's really been a very strong word-of-mouth hit at the art house circuit.
Well, now, a couple things. War Horse is only open in a few territories, so that still has most of its it still has most of the world to open in.
Exactly. That's why it's always interesting to look at the worldwide box office. Movies we've forgotten about or put aside or think are old news, like Alvin and the Chipmunks and Puss in Boots, they're still very, very strong, going big all over the world.
That's right. Now, you mentioned The Untouchables, which is this French film about a paraplegic and his friend.
Quadriplegic. Isn't he quadriplegic? Maybe I'm wrong.
I'll go with quadriplegic. But you mentioned that there was some controversy about that, and I guess Variety critic Jay Weisberg wrote that the film, quote, flings about the kind of Uncle Tom racism one hopes has permanently exited American screens.
Yeah, it's the illegal immigrant is apparently Senegalese. So he obviously French is the second language in Senegal, so he's fluent in French. And he is the caregiver for this quadriplegic multi-zillionaire. And their raucous, hilarious, you know, humor. He brings the old man back to life with his lovable simplicity, I guess, is the idea behind this. We haven't seen it. It's a massive hit in France. We'll have to see how it plays here, if it is offensive or stupid or, you know, who knows.
But, you know, I think that a lot of, you know, Americans often look down on the French as being somewhat racist.
I mean, if you're black, I mean, for generations, your welcoming, then welcoming nature of France for black people is almost a cliche. How welcome and respected and admired. They love jazz. They love film. They love the arts. The black people can live in France and be in, treated civilly and have, you know, multiracial relationships or date people of their own race and be part of the French community. I mean, that's just a sort of a cliche for the past 60, 80 years, I would say. I'd say now that France has a certain anti-immigrant aura about it for various reasons, but
maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
Black people specifically, I think, have often seen Paris and France as a refuge compared to the North America.
Yeah, maybe it's the anti-immigrant stance that I'm thinking.
No, I mean, we haven't seen this film. We know nothing about it. We just know it's a massive, 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 unbelievable commercial hit. It really struck a nerve. Why it might be, what the cultural tropes are in it, or how it might play out in America, it'll be fascinating to see.
Well, now, have you seen a film called The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo? This is the English language remake by David Fincher of the very popular Swedish film.
Well, it's another version of the book. I don't know if it's a remake of that film as such. It's another stab at doing the book, I would say.
Good point. Yes,
they're almost both done at the same time. I haven't seen either of them, and I haven't read the book.
Okay, I saw the Fincher version, and I don't know why it is not doing better than it here in the United States than it did. I guess where are we on this film? It's up to $76 million, and everybody is saying, "Oh, well, it's not doing as well here in the U.S. So it should have made $100 million already."
Well, it's a massive literary property. It's Daniel Craig off the James Bond series. The books could not be more visible in the cultural sphere. So, I mean, obviously they had much higher expectations than $100 million worldwide so far. It hasn't even made as much as the original Swedish film. So, you know, that's certainly not what you expect when you do a Hollywood remake.
That's true. The whole reason you do a Hollywood remake is so that you could, you know, apparently, according to many, make more money because more people speak English than, say, Swedish.
Yeah, and then look at Tintin, which people keep saying whenever they talk about the U.S. grosses, they say, well, thank goodness for international because, you know, it's a big hit overseas. But it's not. It's only grossed like $255 million overseas. Its total worldwide is $315 million. They claim, and the numbers have gone down. This drives me nuts. At first, I saw it cost whatever amount to make. Then I saw it cost $150 million. Now the latest report in Variety was like, well, the filmmakers say it costs $125. They keep lowering the amount the movie costs to make because they want to make it look like more of a hit. But this film probably cost a good $150 million to make. It was a massive worldwide release, so it probably cost $150 million to release and market and print and advertising and all that. So that's a $300 million budget. With $300 million worldwide for a movie directed by Spielberg, produced by Peter Jackson, from one of the most popular fictional characters in history, I don't see how this is anything but a disappointment. I would hesitate to do the sequel, frankly.
I don't think they are doing a sequel, are they? I know that...
Well, they had a planned trilogy. Peter Jackson's directing the second, and then they were going to figure out who did the third. I mean, it's in the works. Whether they're actually going to go through with it at this point or whether it's too late to pull the plug, I don't know those details. But if I had the choice right now looking at this, I don't think I would make a sequel.
Well, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is a trilogy as well, the Stieg Larsson trilogy of books, and Sony says...
I would say that's in jeopardy, too, though. They want to insist it isn't so that they can get people to go to the box office.
Right. They're saying, no, we're going to continue making the film, you know.
Yeah, but there's no way. You know, they're not going to make it if they lost $100 million. And, you know, why would they continue? They'll have some kill fee. I mean, you know, why would you make the second and the third if it didn't work?
Yeah, I'm sure that they will say that overall it did work probably with video and everything else counted in.
No, but you're saying they're going to absolutely make the sequel.
I think they probably will.
But the DVD now is a little bit lower than it used to be. You can't depend on making back, you know, your box office or half your box office anymore on DVD. Certainly you would expect this with the name brand and the value of the book that a lot of people wouldn't have seen the film and would want to rent it or, you know, buy it on DVD just to check it out. But, you know.
Good point.
Yeah. I don't know. If I had my choice, again, if the deals weren't so complicated or wasn't already in the works, you know, it's not like The Hobbit where they're actually filming both of them at the same time. They have presumably the ability to shut down Tintin and shut down the second and third movies in Dragon Tattoo.
That's true. Yeah.
If it doesn't make money, why do it? Has there ever been a proposed trilogy where, like, we are making three films and they pull the plug before it ends?
I don't know. That's a good question. I'm sure there is, but, you know, on the spur of the moment here, I can't think of it.
I can't either. And is War Horse a success? I guess we have a long way to go before we figure that out.
Yeah.
Certainly in North America, it's not a success.
No, not at all.
It's okay. But it's Spielberg. It's grossed $56 million and counting in North America. It's still doing well. It's held pretty well. It's made $8.6 million this weekend in North America. It's only three weekends out. It's had pretty solid word of mouth. It looks like it might get close to $80 million, something like that. Unless it, you know, garners tons of Oscar nominations or something like that and gets new momentum.
I don't think it will, but that's you know, beside the point. Now, a film that is doing incredibly well in China, and it is the Christian Bale drama directed by Zhang Yimou, Flowers of War. It made, what was it, $76 million? No, $83 million in 17 days in China.
Yeah, in 17 days, it became the third highest grossing Chinese film in history. And as far as Western films, it beat out this year's release of Harry Potter, the final Harry Potter film. And it's probably closing in on Kung Fu Panda 2, which grossed $92 million throughout its entire run. And that's just in 17 days. This is a drama which did not get good reviews from Western critics. Christian Bale made the news, though. He was in China promoting the film. Then he tried to go speak to a conscientious objector who's under house arrest. And security guards and cops, like, hustled him away and like pushed him away and said, get away from here. You know, they had to travel to this little village by car with an interpreter and journalist to try and get this interview with this, you know, political prisoner. And that made big news around the world, though presumably not in China since they would have censored that. So, you know, it's very interesting to see what's going on with this film. It has not done well in North America, obviously.
Has it been released in North America?
It was released for a qualifying run, I thought, wasn't it?
Okay, so it was released maybe just in New York or LA for a week.
Yes, like I believe so.
And then we'll
obviously it would not be up for Best Picture as such. It would be more foreign film, but
that's right. Yeah. Well, now you tried to move us into some of the awards news, and as we started recording today, the Directors Guild nominees for Best Director of the Year were announced, and we have Woody Allen for Midnight in Paris, David Fincher for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which was a bit of a surprise, Michael Hazanavicius I now know how to pronounce his name after 8 months. For The Artist, Alexander Payne for The Descendants, which was expected, and Martin Scorsese also expected for Hugo. So really only one surprise. Well, maybe two if you count Woody Allen.
Well, I don't know if that's a surprise. I mean, they've always loved him. It's the biggest hit of his career. It has a lot of momentum. I think it's going to be, you know, one of the big Oscar winners come nomination day. But yeah, so these are their equivalent of the Best Picture and, of course, Best Director slots. Midnight in Paris, Girl with Dragon Tattoo, The Artist, The Descendants, and Hugo. If you think of that as their nominees for Best Picture, that pairs up perfectly with the Producers Guild. They name their 10 best films of the year as far as producing is concerned, and all those five films appear on it, as well as Bridesmaids, The Help, Ides of March, Moneyball, and Steven Spielberg's War Horse.
What I love is like all the headlines around this, the Producers Guild, you know, nominated Bridesmaids of all films. Oh, what a shock. And I'm thinking, well, you know, it was a much beloved film. It made $300 million around the world. I don't understand why everybody's so surprised that people remember it at the end of the year.
Because it's not a classy film.
Okay.
It's women with diarrhea jokes and throwing up, and it's a raunchy comedy, which does not tend to get a lot of respect come the end of the year.
Just ask, you know, the folks who made The Hangover.
Well, exactly. And the Producers Guild had five films nominated for Best Animated Film: Tintin, Cars 2, Kung Fu Panda 2, Puss in Boots, and Rango, which is probably the wild card among those.
Now, what do you think? I mean, Puss in Boots, I can't see really winning. Cars 2 is like, does Pixar just get a pass? And Adventures of Tintin. I mean, I'm sure, you know, a lot, frankly, Adventures of Tintin probably should win just for its sheer, you know, the feat of what it.
I think it looks terrible.
Oh, you think it looks okay?
I cannot understand why they made the film this way. A, Tintin should have been hand drawn. It's a classic property. Hand drawn would have just been more in the spirit of the story and the original strips and things created by Hergé. I don't know how to say his name. I apologize for that. But to me, hand drawn was the way to go for the, you know, some things work in computer animation, some things work with puppetry, some things work in hand drawn. This should have been hand drawn. But I saw the film, the technical stuff of the 3D was fine, but I thought, like all the others, that they looked lifeless and dull and dead. I think it's just an ugly film. They look like walking zombies. They really do.
And this is the first film where people are saying, oh, we finally crossed that uncanny valley, as they call it, that dead eye
syndrome.
Well,
they were wrong.
Yeah, I think the
only one that worked was Avatar, and that's because they had cat eyes. So unless you're making a film about cats, it still doesn't work.
Yeah, I think it's really people hoping that we've crossed the uncanny valley, and this is the best attempt at it, and it's probably the most realistic, even though I agree with you. There was something kind of missing in those eyes.
Yeah, well, I mean, just the film, I just don't find it an attractive-looking film. It's just sort of ugly. It's not live action. It doesn't really feel like the fancifulness of animation. It's just sort of zombie in-between world, where it's just nothing is quite that satisfying. But I think Rango has a lot of old Hollywood satire in it. It's sort of an ode to the spaghetti westerns, among other things. It has Johnny Depp. I think it's sort of a wild card. I know people were very fond of it who saw it at the time.
I saw it, and I was very fond of it. And it wasn't for kids, but I thought it was a great animated film.
Yeah, so we'll have to see. And then the Writers Guild had their nominations. And these are really the ones that matter: the Writers Guild, the Producers Guild, the Directors Guild, the SAG, because they're going to actually vote a lot of these same people for the Oscars. And the Writers Guild, of course, had 10 screenplays nominated, 5 original and 5 adapted. If we look back at the director's nominees, which were Midnight in Paris, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, The Artist, The Descendants, and Hugo, we will see that Midnight in Paris, The Descendants, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, The Descendants, everything but The Artist was nominated for a Writers Guild Award. The Artist did not make a nomination, so that shows them a little less love for The Artist. Maybe it's because it's silent? I don't know.
Yeah, people probably overlooked the writing in that film. Although, let's face it, it's almost harder to write a silent movie because you have to write out each action. So, I don't know.
Well, and there was dialogue in the you know, subtitling.
That's true.
Not subtitling, but whatever it's called.
Intertitles.
Thank you. But so I don't know why the Writers Guild did not appreciate the feat that was The Artist, but their choices for Best Original Screenplay were Bridesmaids, 50-50, the cancer film, Midnight in Paris, Win-Win, the very good film from earlier in the year starring Paul Giamatti, and Young Adult, the film by Diablo Cody.
And I have to say, Win-Win, very well worth seeing. It's a great film.
Yes, I would strongly recommend renting it too. And then Best Adapted Screenplay, The Descendants, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, Help, Hugo, and Moneyball.
Is it Help or The Help? It's The Help.
It's The Help. I had written Help by accident. Okay. And what do all these lists have in common? The Producers Guild, the Directors Guild, the Writers Guild. They have one thing in common. No Terrence Malick. Not for producing, he wouldn't be up for producing, but his film could have been. Not for writing and not for directing, which is probably the biggest surprise. So no love for Terrence Malick from any of them. It's looking dimmer and dimmer that Tree of Life will scrape onto the Best Picture of the Year nominees list.
Well, I thought it was, you know, looking dimmer and dimmer as the credits rolled on that film when we saw it in Cannes. I didn't think it would be remembered, except for maybe cinematography, which was absolutely a beautiful film to look at. But story-wise, I thought, yes, it is adventurous, it is different, but I didn't think it would be Best Picture material at the end of the year. Maybe Best Director, just because, you know, for taking the chance, but... You know, Malick was out there. He takes chances with all of his films.
That was your personal opinion. But once you saw the reviews, didn't you? I mean, it's not about what you personally think of a movie. It's, you know, how it's going to do, you know, among the Oscar voters.
Yeah, but I felt that Oscar voters would all be on my side. They're all right here, in, you know, in the studio, and they all agree with me.
Well, it's one of the best reviewed films of the year by far. It's been on a number of critics' lists. It's only at 84% on Rotten Tomatoes, if that means anything.
I don't know whether that means anything anymore. That's a good question. I ask myself that
among top critics, it's at 88%.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, critics loved it.
Well, we were going to talk about the annual box office, but I think we're going to cover that in depth next week, so we should save it, even though you mentioned at the top of the show. And, you know, we're covering the Writers Guild and the Directors Guild and the Producers Guild, and, you know, we'll find out who's been prognosticating correctly when we have the Oscars in late February. But in early February, we're going to be having the Grammy Awards. And it's been a pretty good year for music, at least at the sales register. Album sales was 1.3%, but that's the first time since 2004, so that's obviously good news. 330 million physical copies were sold of albums. Yeah, overall, U.S. music sales rose 6.9% in 2011. Album sales increased for the first time in, you know, 7 years. Digital albums rose almost 20%. They sold 103 million copies in digital format. Physical copies of actual CDs dropped 5.7%, but that was made up for by the rise in digital to a degree. 112 songs went platinum, meaning they sold more than 1 million digital copies. 38 songs went double platinum, meaning they sold more than 2 million copies. That's a lot, and we've really returned to the era where the single is king.
That's right. Thank you, Steve Jobs.
Yeah, people are buying albums, but you know the single is really where it's at now. And you can see that when you look at the list of the best-selling albums of the year. We should say digital tracks overall hit a new high of 1.27 billion copies. And some people always like to talk about vinyl. USA Today referred to the exploding vinyl sector. Oh my God, vinyl is back. Yes, vinyl sales rose 36%.
And this is why statistics can tell any story, because if you really look at that, vinyl sales only total 3.9 million copies. Didn't we just say something in the billions there? I'm pretty sure we did. Yeah.
Exactly. 3.9 million copies, which is like far less than 1% of the total album sales and dwarfed entirely by total digital track sales. It's a meaningless little blip. It has nothing to do with, you know, it's not coming back. People aren't going to start buying albums in vinyl anymore. It's just something for, you know, arcane collectors.
USA Today was just trying to prove how hip they were.
That's right. But you look at the best-selling albums of the year. Adele had the album of the year, obviously, with 21. It grossed sold 5.8 million copies. That's the most for an album in a year since Usher's Confessions sold 8 million copies a number of years ago. Number two was Michael Bublé's Christmas, 2.4 million copies. Number three, Lady Gaga with Born This Way at 2.1 million copies. And that's it. Only the top three albums went double platinum, sold 2 million or more copies. That's the world we're in now. That is so, I still haven't really adjusted to that because that just seems so remarkably low to me when I'm used to the era of the 80s and early 90s when albums had sold 5, 8, 10 million copies in the blink of an eye. Garth Brooks, every album he released sold 8, 9 million copies. So to have only three albums and all of the albums released this year sell more than 2 million copies is just sort of a shocker to me.
Well, and then you have, you know, acts like Mumford & Sons with Sigh No More or Lady Antebellum with Own the Night. These are two huge bands now. And at least over the past year, they have been. And those were huge albums. And yet they sold 1.4 million and 1.2 million albums, respectively. It just, you're right, it is very, very low.
Well, they're not huge bands in the sense of sales. They're huge bands in the sense they had the commercial momentum. Lady Antebellum had a couple big singles. Mumford & Sons is more of a critically acclaimed act that sort of organically grew, which is sort of great to see them sell 1.4 million copies. They're more of a draw on the road. And touring people are really excited by them. They think like, Mumford & Sons are going to be a touring act for many years to come, and they need an infusion of new touring acts because you can't have the Rolling Stones coming out every year.
That's true. Now, Hypebot, highlighted that indie labels were just 12% of 2011 U.S. sales. So these are all the labels that aren't like, say, Universal Music Group, which was 29.9% of U.S. music sales. Sony Corp was 29.3%, just behind Universal Music Group. Warner's Music Group was 19.1%. So you're already up to, what is that, like 80%?
80%, yeah.
Roughly. Yeah, EMI coming in fourth at 9.6%. And then you have all the indies at 12.1%. So, you know, the big music labels still dominate.
They dominate sales, yes.
Yes, yeah. Well, yeah, that's right. They may not be dominating the...
But the road is where the money is. And on the road, of course, you still have big acts like U2. U2 had the biggest grossing tour of the year.
Is that a surprise, though? I mean, look at, you know, the venues they were playing were huge, and the ticket prices were huge, so...
Well, they're playing those huge venues because they're popular.
That's
right. They're not selling a lot of tickets because they're in a big venue.
That's true. And the average ticket price was $97, and at least here in L.A., you had to pay like $200, $250 if you wanted to get even anywhere close to the stage.
That's how you get to an average price of $97.
That's right. Well, and rounding out the top five highest grossing acts were Taylor Swift made $97.7 million, Kenny Chesney $84.6 million. So if you want a good tour, go country. Lady Gaga made $63.7 million, and Bon Jovi came in fifth, $57.1 million.
You just love those points, don't you? You love every little penny. Worldwide, U2 was still the biggest, followed by Take That, the super boy band group from the UK that had reunited. They grossed $224 million. Bon Jovi was third worldwide with $148 million. Taylor Swift, $104 million. I assume that's worldwide. That's another, you know, $7 million. Or did she, is that over, these are not overseas figures. These are worldwide.
Those
right?
are worldwide grosses. So
and
yes.
So she did like $7 million in sales overseas. So she's not a big draw around the world, or she just hasn't toured yet. And Roger Waters grossed $103 million worldwide. So add them all up together. The top 25 biggest tours grossed a combined $2.1 billion worldwide, about the same as last year.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think that it would make, you know, touring would make more money than that, wouldn't you? I mean, for all the press that it gets and all the hype, you know, you'd think that it would be like a $10 billion industry, and it's not.
Well, it's you know, it's expensive and hard to do. It's, you know, you've got to physically be there. You can't show U2 on a screen and have people go all over the country to see it at the same time. They have to physically go from town to town.
Good point, yeah. And as you say, it's expensive to do and do
yeah,
well.
And, you know, it's a lot of work to reach, you know, they U2 sold 1.7 million tickets in North America. That's a lot of tickets. Worldwide, they sold 2.3 million tickets. You know, that's them, the biggest act in the world, touring and touring and touring and touring, and they still only sold 2.3 million tickets.
And you know what? I bet you more than 2.3 million people saw The Devil Inside this weekend.
That's right. Average ticket price of about $8, I think, in North America now. That means for 38 million, that means that 4 million to 5 million people saw the movie.
Yeah, so there you go. This week in math. On next week, we will be doing my taxes. Well, we should probably move along to theater news, don't you think?
Absolutely.
Well, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we'd be discussing how touring affects, or maybe the better word is enhances, the success of many Broadway shows. Patrick Healy, the theater news and features reporter for the New York Times, joins us to explain how sometimes it doesn't matter if you make it big on the Great White Way, provided you're a hit in Buffalo. Patrick, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, now, the reason we wanted to talk to you, besides the fact that you write at least, you know, a gazillion stories a week for the Times, and you're filling my RSS reader at least, we read something over the holiday break about the Shea Performing Arts Center in Buffalo and how it's actually turning some Broadway musicals into big hits.
That's right. That's right. It's really become a sort of go-to tour destination for musicals on Broadway that may not be making money in New York, but then are able to go out and make a whole lot of money in cities like Buffalo, Cleveland, Sacramento, and pay back their investors who saw sort of a flop happen on Broadway, but then something more lucrative happen on the road.
Yeah, Patrick, we've known for a while how important the road is to Broadway, and they certainly don't want to think of Broadway as a lost leader, but it is sort of what you're seeing with one show that you talked about, which is The Addams Family. It ran on Broadway for 22 months. It cost $16 million to put on, and it didn't make back all that money, but it could do that now that it's on the road and pulling in a lot of people.
That's right. I mean, they've been pretty strategic about booking in cities where the touring houses have strong subscription bases where they know, like in a place like Buffalo, that they'll already have, 60% of their seats sold for the entire tour stop of the Addams Family before a single ticket actually goes on sale. So it's something that Broadway producers are certainly just more and more strategic about, taking shows out on tour. Like, it's no surprise the Book of Mormon is going to tour. It's going to be a massive, hit, I'm sure, on the road like it is on Broadway. But shows that, haven't necessarily done so well on Broadway, shows like Shrek and Legally Blonde that were seen as financial flops, and The Addams Family, which was less of a financial flop, it's making back a good deal of its money on Broadway, still go out on the road and are able to sort of transform their business plan.
You know, I was actually really surprised at all of these shows are actually vying for these positions in Buffalo and Cleveland and in Oregon, wherever the regional theater might be. It's kind of like a big get to wind up with a subscription position in Buffalo, because you have already sold 60% of your tickets. I didn't realize that the subscription series or the subscription ticketing was that high, A, and B, that it was so competitive to land a date in Buffalo.
Yeah, it is a really high percentage. I was surprised by that too. I mean, what the presenters said that I have no reason to think otherwise and makes some intuitive sense is that in some of these cities like Cleveland and Buffalo, there is sort of a season mentality that they play into with their advertising and marketing overtures to possible theater goers, that a lot of these people are used to buying season tickets to the Bills or the Sabres or the Cleveland Browns, the sports teams. They're used to buying sort of concert packages for the winter months because there's not a lot that's going on outdoors, in those cities. And the theater, they try to sort of piggyback on that mentality in some of those cities. There are other cities that just are very strategic about choosing, let's say, five or six shows a year to put on their subscription package that they feel like will really satisfy the taste of the theater goers. I mean, they've got a lot of tours to choose from, and trying to decide, okay, which are the five or six that would fit together during this season, where it's not going to feel like, okay, you've just got all these dance shows or you've got too many jukebox shows, where you can sort of space them out. And then also playing to taste. I mean, some cities are going to be into South Pacific and Les Mis and seeing that for a fourth time instead of seeing, let's say, Spring Awakening or American Idiot, which are more shows more aimed at younger people, for even the first time. They'd rather have Les Mis for the fourth time than, Spring Awakening for the first time.
And of course, it's always a balancing act to figure out when to go on the road. They usually want to be on Broadway for at least, 8 months or a year so that they've established themselves, yep, and proven themselves as a hit and given themselves a shot at Tony Awards, and then they go out on the road. I think it's usually about a year or a year and a half even before, yep, they even think, yep, about doing that. Isn't that right?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, they definitely want to establish some kind of a brand, try to develop some kind of, word of mouth among the tourist market, and then sort of depending on what their experience is and what their sense of how many theater goers they can get on the road. And then a lot of it's producers' relationships with the different presenting houses around the country, and everything from how big the stage is, what the load-in costs would be. I mean, some theaters are a lot bigger than others. Shays in Buffalo, this theater that I wrote about, they rebuilt a lot of the back end of their theater once the Phantom of the Opera tours came in, because they knew that it could be a very lucrative tour, but they couldn't actually physically get the set in without doing, sort of double duty overtime work, which would cut into the cost. So it sort of depends on which theater you're going to that can easily accommodate a show.
Well, you had another great story about looking back at the year of 2011. And of course, one of the big stories was Spider-Man for about eight different reasons. And
sure,
That's a really big question mark for the road as well. Obviously, you have to open on Broadway before you can open on the road. So they had a year of previews practically, but they're on Broadway. They're making money week to week. And they're a great example of a show that has established a brand on Broadway, but clearly is not would take years to make their money back. So they're going to go out on the road having proven themselves as a tourist draw. But the question is, I think, whether they're actually going to go on the road to these houses, even the big ones like Shea, or whether they're going to go to bigger venues. Because I think their plan was always to try and play like a Madison Square Garden type space where they could really pack people in and make it some sort of spectacle. Do people know whether that's coming on the road? Are they talking about that?
It's a really interesting question. They say, the producers now say, that they have sort of changed their mind about creating spin-off productions from the Broadway one and going overseas or doing a tour of the United States or doing what's called a sit-down, you know, multi-month production in like L.A. or Chicago. Mm-hmm. And they've sort of put those plans on hold and are focusing just on the Broadway production to sort of increase the brand value there. Now, there's a few reasons for this. One is they have an enormous theater on Broadway. The show has proved to be particularly popular among tourists. So they're sort of saying, you know, why spend all the money on creating, you know, the apparatus for a tour and moving it around, which would be very complicated given the flying that goes on and the special effects in the show. And instead, let's just try to keep filling this, you know, nearly 2,000 seat theater 8 times a week with a whole lot of tourists who are coming from the cities that we might otherwise take the road show to. The other thing is they're in a lawsuit right now with their former director, Julie Taymor, and one of the issues that's going to be, you know, I think decided or maybe settled will be the whole issue of royalties for future productions of the show. So I think that they are leery about going overseas, going out on the road while this unknown royalty issue is still out there. They don't want to have to pay Julie Taymor any more money than they have to. The reality is, if they were to open a production of Spider-Man in London next year and it was a massive hit, or more likely in like Hamburg or the Netherlands, and it was a massive hit, or take it on the road in the United States and it turned out to be really profitable, they don't want to have to be giving money to Julie or, you know, have it tied up in some sort of frozen, you know, holding pattern while judges figure out, you know, who has a copyright to what in the show. So it's kind of complicated, but it is interesting. Right now, their view is, they told me that for the first time they believe, and this is true, they were denying it before, for the first time they believe they could make that $75 million back on Broadway, which, you know, would take about 5 or 6 years, which would require, you know, would take probably a good 5 or 6 years, would require it to be a hit, you know, maybe not on the scale of Lion King and Wicked, but certainly bigger than Hairspray, maybe even bigger than The Producers, which was a hot show for a long time. It would really need to become sort of like a Mamma Mia, but even it's in a much bigger theater than Mamma Mia is. I mean, Mamma Mia is it's running in a 1,500-seat theater, and Spider-Man's in a nearly 2,000-seat theater. But I would need to have that, this show that tourists loved. Mamma Mia pulls in a lot of people who don't speak English, and Spider-Man is having that sort of same success. They just want that spectacle.
But people would go back to see Mamma Mia more than once, and I don't see people – I mean, every time I hear the music from Spider-Man, I think, oh, boy, did they ruin that. And I just think, I would never want to see this show more than once. I would see it once for the spectacle, and that's it. I wouldn't buy the soundtrack, most likely, even though it is by U2.
But their plan is to add in like a new song or a new event scene so that there's a new reason to go
back. They're talking about that, exactly. The thing about adding something in every year to try to get people back. And the reality is, like, they're aiming a lot of that sort of a double, the repeat business is really aimed at kids and families. I mean, a lot of people with, you know, mature tastes have, you know, a really dim view of the Spider-Man score. You know, there are other people who are, you know, U2 heads from all around the world who, when they're in New York, if they're thinking about a Broadway show, you know, they may not know what they're getting into, but they know that it's U2, and you know, they may buy into that. But I think they're also helping on this kid market, sort of kids saying, who are introduced to theater through Spider-Man, and then the parents might hope, okay, now the kid's going to want to see, you know, another show and expand their taste. But reality is, you know, a lot of kids just want to have the same experience over and over again. And they'll say, no, let's go see Spider-Man again. And
you take your daughter to see Wicked and you take your son to see Spider-Man, I guess.
But, well, there's a lot of that. I mean, there are a lot. Wicked certainly does a lot of repeat business among, you know, among certainly young girls. I mean, the audience is a lot more diverse than just, you know, teenage girls. But, you know, in terms of the true believers, let's say, you know, a lot of it is that young girl market.
That's a big road to hoe, because if Spider-Man runs for 5 years, it will be one of the 30 longest running shows in Broadway history. But it could help if
you're right. But you know what? It's a little, I don't know if you call it baffling or bedeviling. There were so many Broadway insiders back in June and July who were insisting that Spider-Man would be dead by New Year's. Some were insisting it would close after, you know, after Labor Day. Some were insisting, but a lot of very smart people who weren't competing directly against Spider-Man were just insisting that the numbers would not hold, that the audience would not hold. And, you know, just last week grossed, you know, the highest amount in Broadway history. And if those numbers are to be believed, you know, they have a real audience for the show.
Now, I believe that was $2.9 million in a single week. Is that
with an extra
staggering
show?
Yeah. Even with the extra show, it's just, I mean, I remember when shows started nudging over the $2 million mark, people were, you know, it was taking the breath away of some people. And that was just a couple of years ago. And the idea that it would be Spider-Man that nearly hits $3 million is,
well, one thing that could help Spider-Man would be Tony Award nominations, which probably seems unlikely, but it'll be in the running. Obviously, we're looking at the Tony Awards in the spring, and there's going to be shows competing for Best New Musical, and The Road is a big part of that. As you talk about in your story about Buffalo and The Road, the 15% of the Tony voters are Road producers, people connected to The Road, and they like to see fun, family-friendly, sellable shows. Even though they say, hey, we love art too, they clearly would like to see fun, family-friendly shows, and that would mean probably a face-off between Newsies and Once. Of course, we're speculating wildly because they haven't all opened and, you know, voters have to vote
on
them. But those look like the early favorites. But Spider-Man could be a family-friendly, tour-friendly show as well.
Agreed. I mean, I have a feeling that Newsies is going to gobble up, and I bet you probably agree with me, that Newsies is probably going to gobble up a big chunk of the Road vote, which is anywhere usually from about 15% of the total, you know, Tony voter share. It seems like they built Newsies to tour. That was sort of the idea.
Yeah.
And Newsies appeals to every member of your family, the mom, the dad, you know, the two dads, the two moms, the kids, I mean, whoever, you know, it's got something kind of for everyone. And it feels like a touring show. The reality is the Spider-Man, I tend to think they're going to go to continental Europe, Japan, South Korea before they're going to take it on tour. And you mentioned earlier, they thought of a tour as like a Madison Square Garden thing. That's exactly right. They're thinking of it as like one or two nights at arenas, which is something that's different than Shea's Buffalo. You know, it's more going to like a 15,000 person arena and, you know, trying to sell as much of that as possible and maybe even amping up the flying in some, you know, hyped way, you know, or going to like Vegas. And that's, there's less purchase on the Road Tony voters when that's your business strategy.
So what are you most looking forward to in the spring as we look ahead into the spring of 2012 and the rest of the Broadway season?
Sure. I'm looking forward to Newsies. It seems like Jeremy Jordan, sort of the Broadway star of the moment, you know, is going to go back to it. So I'm sort of curious.
Is that official?
It's not official, but he's basically saying it's going to happen. He said it's safe to say, and it definitely sounds like it's going to happen. So I'm looking forward to that. Looking forward to seeing how Once does, this sort of Irish sort of romance drama musical. It's playing off Broadway in a very intimate space and, you know, is now moving to a theater that's more than twice as big. So I'm curious how that transfers up there. I'm looking forward to Evita with Ricky Martin to see how that flies, how Ricky Martin does.
Well, he's been on stage before.
End of the Rainbow, which is this sort of Judy Garland show that's coming from, about Judy Garland just weeks before her death in London, kind of losing it. It just sounds, you know, a bit like a, you know, a big diva moment. And then play-wise, I already saw it, and I'm really curious to see how it does. Is an import from the National Theatre of London called One Man, Two Governors that is very, very British in terms of its humor. You know, it's also pretty heavy on the Commedia dell'arte and how that flies. I mean, I talked to the head of the National Theatre last summer, and he was, I think, genuinely puzzled and worried about whether One Man, Two Governors would work here. You know, they sent over History Boys, a little worried about that. It worked on Broadway, but it wasn't a massive hit, but it still had a, you know, a room full of schoolboys that the audience could sort of relate to in different ways. They sent over War Horse. They were really worried about how War Horse would work with this like puppet show about World War One. You know, Brits and Germans and French would have appeal here. And it worked. And now One Man, Two Governors is, you know, a sort of 50s era farce with thick accents and a lot of sort of tomfoolery on stage. And they just, back in the summer, they were really skeptical, you know, that Broadway audiences would find the humor and be clamoring for it, that it might turn into like a Labette, you know, kind of a flat, strange British concoction. And I'm curious to see how it does. I thought it was hysterical, and you know, I was a thinker that they should bring it over here. So we'll see.
Well, we kind of have Hollywood turning to Broadway more and more. In fact, I'm waiting for the announcement for the Star Wars musical with the Rolling Stones writing the score or something. But we have this year's It Girl, Jessica Chastain, who stars in, I think by law she has to star in every single movie made by Hollywood this year, and she's a front runner now for, you know, an Oscar nomination. She's coming to Broadway in The Heiress. And then you have Hugh Jackman, who is coming back to Broadway because I guess, you know, he just can't get away. He was just on Broadway, it seems like. Mm-hmm. And he's going to be doing Houdini. So that seems to be more and more a trend. And is there a reason for that in your mind?
Yeah, I think that the Broadway sort of seems like savings bonds to people. I mean, they're putting money in. A lot of shows don't make their money back, but a lot of shows do and do well. The Broadway audience has not disappeared in spite of the recession. Broadway used to be seen as an incredibly kind of risky investment, and it's certainly not a safe bet with only 20% of shows recouping here, but the possibility of rights and licensing and sort of as a long-term investment seems to be growing more and more, and the way to bank it, you know, safer and safer is to have, you know, a Hollywood name, someone who may well, as you pointed out, you know, win an Oscar this year, who would come back and, you know, appear on Broadway in something like The Heiress. So you do see that. And I think it's safe to say that at this point, you know, Broadway producers and Hollywood producers are fully bonded, aligned, collaborating on figuring out ways to exploit each other's properties and turn them into, you know, versions of themselves for the different mediums.
Well, you know, certainly lining up a bankable movie star has been the way Hollywood has worked for eons, since its inception, frankly.
Sure.
And I think
Broadway's the same way. You get Nathan Lane, you got yourself you're going to sell tickets.
Yeah, but I think that in Hollywood, if you said, look, you know, you're all going to make movies, but only 20% of you will make your money back, I think there, you know, you'd find it hard to locate an investor. And yet, you, as you just mentioned, only 20% of the Broadway shows, be it a play or a musical, make their money back on Broadway. It's really this touring that helps make all these shows, if not profitable, at least break even.
Well, part of it is just that. It's not as if people said, okay, once upon a time, 100% of Broadway shows turned a profit. Now it's only 20%, which would make you think, okay, this is not something you want to put money into. It's never, you know, it's gone, you know, steadily downward. I think it's always been, you know, kind of a bettor's market. I mean, there are a lot of Broadway producers who really are gamblers. Some of them, you know, race racehorses. Some of them are at the track all the time. You know, some of them love casinos down in Florida or out west. I mean, they've got sort of gambler's moxie. The other thing is you have a lot of investors who look at it as the possibility of, you know, a Wicked, a payoff. I mean, a show that you wouldn't necessarily have thought was going to be some you know, mass, you know, some big success that now will keep people rich for a long, long time. You know, and then there are plenty of other people who just love theater, want to be in the game, want to go to the Tony Awards if they think maybe their show will get a nomination. And everybody generally does. People don't invest in shows thinking, oh, this is a turkey, it'll never work. You know, they tend to believe in it. And they're prepared to write it off as a tax loss. You know, it's not poor people who are putting money into Broadway shows. A lot of these people see it as somewhat discretionary. They can get a, you know, a tax write-off from it if it doesn't work. And, you know, if they're going to put their money into the stock market and look at possible, you know, heavy losses there, they might as well put their money into a Broadway show and have some fun with it. You know, that said, it's still a very small community, Broadway commercial theater. So it's not as if you have, you know, thousands and thousands of people who are putting money into, you know, one single show. It's still a, you know, pretty tight little investment community.
Well, certainly after reading you, it seems like daily for so many years, it was a pleasure to speak with you. Patrick Healy of the New York Times, your work can be found not only online, but also in print. Now, do you have a Twitter account?
I do. It's Patrick Healy, NYT.
You know, I just can't wait for your story on how movie musicals are being made of Broadway musicals that were originally based on movies.
Right? It's a little head spinning.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to join us and really explain how a lot of these Broadway musicals and plays are making most of their money on the road.
Thank you for having me.
So yeah, that was really interesting. As we mentioned in the piece that, you know, the road for Broadway, they gross $1 billion on the road, just like they do on Broadway. And that's, you know, that's a really important part. I've always known the road was important to Broadway and to its financial health, but I never realized some of the ins and outs of how they work. So that article was a really interesting insight for me.
As I was reading it, I thought, oh, Michael's going to love this. And so I was very happy that Patrick was able to join us. I thought, you know, some of the stuff he mentioned there was kind of a big deal.
I hear what you're doing.
Yes, indeed. I'm moving us along to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. After a 4-year break, most of Van Halen is back in action with a new album and a tour happening. David Lee Roth, remember him? He'll be singing. Eddie Van Halen will be playing guitar. Alex will be on drums, but no Michael Anthony on bass. He's apparently sticking by Sammy Hagar, and Eddie's son is back on bass. They have tickets on sale now, a single out to radio, and an album on Interscope coming soon. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop, except I guess maybe for the album makes it a big deal. But, you know, they've been back together, you know, just a couple years ago. So this is not like some great 20-year-in-the-making reunion.
Yeah, well, you know, like half the band, actually, every member of the band's last name is Van Halen, except for David Lee Roth. They couldn't get a singer named Van Halen. Martha Stewart's lifestyle show is ending. The TV show is getting canceled, and it's a bad thing. After 7 years on the air, 5 in syndication and 2 on the Hallmark Channel, the Martha Stewart Show is saying goodbye in May. How will we ever know what elaborate play settings are needed for the perfect afternoon tea? And is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. The show's been, you know, slipping quietly. I think it's down to like 220,000 viewers an episode. So it's no big surprise. It's kind of surprising that she was able to come back after prison and pick it right up where she left off. And I'm sure she's not done yet. She'll come up with some other venue.
The man who pirated a copy of X-Men Origins Wolverine and posted the work print online a month before the movie opened was sentenced to 1 year in federal prison. New York Gilberto Sanchez, who was 49, had committed a similar offense previously, uploaded the work print with green screen and wires visible, and publicized it on 2 sites and saw it downloaded hundreds of thousands of times. After a year in prison, he'll be on probation and have restrictions on his computer use. This is the film that our friend Roger Friedman wrote an item about online for Fox News. He reviewed the work print, in fact. Friedman contacted Fox News lawyers as soon as he heard about the pirated version, downloaded a copy so he could report on it, and what was included, where, you know, where the special effects finished and so on, that kind of thing. And he wrote an item about the piracy, adding that it might not hurt the film because he thought it looked great. Bizarrely, Fox decided to fire Friedman. So big deal or big whoop that the person who actually leaked this film is finally going to jail.
Well, I think it's a big deal in the scheme of things, but it's perfectly appropriate. You know, this is the worst example of piracy that you can talk about. Taking something that's still being created, stealing it, posting it online. It's not cute. It's not funny. It's not like, you know, a 20-year-old or 10-year-old TV show or album that you're copying from your friends. This is a new product that hasn't even come out yet. You're exposing it to the world in this way, and it's a criminal act. It's not, you know, it's not a petty little thing. He knew it was wrong. He shouldn't have done it, and he deserves to pay the price.
And he most certainly is. Is the idea of women behaving badly so hilarious that you don't need stars? That's what Universal is hoping with a sequel to Bridesmaids. They'd love to have a quickie reunion of the movie's stars for another girl's night out. Get it? Quickie? Get it? Never mind. The problem is that the relatively low-budget comedy, co-written and starring Kristen Wiig, was a massive hit, and the studio only handed out checks for $100,000 to the principals. Peanuts, considering the $32 million film, that's the budget, $32 million is how much the film cost. It grossed $288 million worldwide. The talent were insulted, according to some, and Universal has tried to make nice, but Wiig and Melissa McCarthy have moved on with numerous other projects. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I wish somebody would insult me that way. But I should clarify that the checks were a bonus check that the studio, we believe, was not obligated to pay. Sometimes when a movie is such an outsized hit compared to what people were paid, they do a little make good and say, oh, here's a car, here's a check for a certain amount of money to show their appreciation for having delivered a movie that's, you know, making them hundreds of millions of dollars at the box office. And in this case, we believe that they handed them a bonus check out of their own goodwill, but it was so low, frankly, you know, $100,000 on a movie that, you know, has grossed $280 million, that the principals were insulted, frankly, and said, well, gee, I guess you don't appreciate us. So when the studio came back and said, hey, we want to make a sequel, they were like, never mind.
Well,
in fact,
they even
offered Kristen Wiig a $10 million figure to, you know, co-write and star in it, and she still declined. So that's some bad blood they created on a big hit.
Right. Ron Meyer, the head of Universal, who actually smoothed things over between Jay Leno and Conan when that whole thing blew up, he tried to sit down with Kristen Wiig, and she said, yeah, no thanks. And, you know, we talked about this right before the show, and, you know, there's some question as to whether the $100,000 check was a contracted bonus check, or was whether there was some obligation to pay it, or whether there was no obligation to pay it. But even if it was contracted, I guess really what these actors are saying, and the talent associated here is saying, is look, the bare minimum of a bonus was $100,000, and you did the bare minimum. So maybe we will star in this new film and do the bare minimum of a job.
Exactly.
In the beginning, crowdsource funding for a project was strictly for little-known acts and directors struggling to get ahead. Now, increasingly, it's being used by artists who are far more visible. Pop stars are asking their fans to chip in and fund the recording of a new album. And in Germany, their local version of the UK sitcom The Office, you know, we have one here in the US, is coming to an end this year, but the producers have asked fans to help pay for a feature film spinoff. They've already raised $1.3 million with fans who invest more than 1,000 euros getting an equity stake in the project. More than 3,000 people have contributed so far. So that means at least 3,000 people on opening weekend, which, as we just said, is not a big opening weekend. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. I mean, why a film of this visibility would need to crowdsource the funding is beyond me.
It's a marketing ploy.
No, I don't think it's a marketing ploy as such. I think they're going to fund the film with the money from individual investors. But with a property this visible, why, you know, if it was worth doing, either it's not worth doing, and so they had to turn to individual investors. It just seems weird to me.
James Franco is the latest big name to bypass major publishers and sign a deal with Amazon, the number one bookstore in the world. And you probably remember James Franco, the celebrated author of, he's not an author, is he? His book is tentatively called Actors Anonymous and is loosely based on, guess what, his career. Franco follows in the footsteps of Deepak Chopra, director Penny Marshall, and self-help guru Timothy Ferris as highly desired authors who turned down offers from the Big Six to write for Amazon. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. He hasn't published a book before, but...
He has published one book previously.
Was it a poetry, a book of poetry?
Or? It was like poetry and short stories, and it was published by Scribner.
Well, there you go. So you're wrong. And I think the title is hilarious. Actors Anonymous, AA, is a clever title. But he's a big name. You know, that's the sort of person that a Big Six publisher would want to snag for his first work or first big commercial work. And, you know, this is very, very new territory. A lot of big authors going to Amazon, and bookstores are sort of looking at themselves going, what's going on here? Amazon has become the biggest bookstore, and now they're slowly eliminating publishers.
Viacom must be so very, very sorry that it ever bought the Rock Band franchise. They paid $175 million for the franchise in 2006 to shareholders of the company Harmonix, with promises to pay out more based on future sales. In 2007, they paid out a $150 million bonus. Now that's a bonus, people.
Yeah.
In 2008, they asked if they could have the money back, please, because the shareholders, well, the shareholders, of course, said, no, we don't think so, and sued for more money, understanding that titles in the franchise had sold some $10 million units. Harmonix also created the dance craze game Dance Central. Nonetheless, in 2010, Viacom sold the company for $50 million. Wait a second, $175 million minus 50. I think they sold that at a loss. And now arbitrators have looked into their books and decided Viacom actually owes the shareholders another $383 million. That's a total of $708 million paid out to investors. Now, that's sweet music to the investors and a bit discordant to Viacom. Whoever oversaw that deal is probably overseeing a new job somewhere else by now. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. They're now trying to say in court that they don't want the arbitration to stick, and they're trying to, you know, undo that bit of a problem. But boy, you know, however much money they grossed from this product, you know, paying $708 million and selling for $50 million, that's going to be very hard to make that into a good thing.
Maybe Jerry Garcia should have called his band the Grateful Undead. He may have died in 1995, but his legacy lives on. The band continues to tour under different names. Their music is constantly being repackaged and reissued. And of course, there's that Ben and Jerry's ice cream, Cherry Garcia. Now there's going to be a documentary film. Producer and director Malcolm Leo is best known for cheesy works like reunion specials for Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley and This Is Elvis. But he also did a Beach Boys documentary some 25 years ago and somehow has convinced the Garcia estate to let him dive into the treasure trove of material and make a film about Garcia. Leo already has a three-hour interview he did with Garcia in 1987 when the band was enjoying a fluke top 10 hit with Touch of Grey. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop given his track record. You knew something about Garcia and or the Grateful Dead was inevitable. Whether he's the best guy to do it, looking at his credits, I don't really think so, but maybe it's a passion project of his. I'm not quite sure how he got Garcia and did that long sit down, whether he covered his whole career, whether he's a lifelong fan. You know, all those things can really make, you know, a project really important and special for someone. So maybe this is his dream project for his entire life. But if I was a Dead fan, I wouldn't exactly be chomping at the bit to see it.
According to one analyst, Netflix is now the 15th most watched network on TV. If you count up the quote-unquote viewers on Netflix each night, it ranks up there with the major networks and top cable channels like ESPN, USA, and the like. If you look at how it fares only in homes where they subscribe to Netflix, then the channel would be ranked number 2 behind only the number 1 network, CBS. It has more hours of viewing in a month than FX, HGTV, and the History Channel, and had more than twice the viewer hours of CNN, Discovery, MSNBC, and BET. I would say big deal or big whoop, but I think, Michael, we both know this is a big deal.
It is a big deal, though, of course. Is it apples and oranges? I mean, are we comparing the viewing hours of Time Warner Cable with, you know, the Sci-Fi Channel? Is that what we're doing, a single channel versus a cable outlet that offers a whole array of programming? Because Netflix sort of has access to so many thousands of hours of films and TV shows that it seems not quite the same as comparing it to, you know, TNT and USA.
Well, playing devil's advocate here, I would say, look, you know, there's, what, 300 channels on your Time Warner basic cable subscription. So the same could be said about Time Warner Cable.
No, I'm saying exactly. I'm saying we're treating Netflix. The better comparison would be how much watching do you do on Time Warner Cable, not how much watching do you do on MTV.
Okay.
We're comparing the array of channels and things available on Netflix to ESPN, where I'm saying actually it should be compared more to something like Time Warner Cable because they're offering such a wide array of stuff.
Because they're both content providers, really.
Right, with tons of different stuff on it. Every channel obviously has to have an array of programming. USA does, TNT does, MTV does. They all have different shows and movies and specials and reruns. But it seems like Netflix, to me, is slightly broader than a typical channel. It seems more akin to a cable provider. But that's just my opinion.
Well, you know, the new year did not bring any good news for Netflix. Or frankly, Redbox or Blockbuster. HBO has said they're not going to be selling DVDs to Netflix anymore. And, you know, they're in this battle with each other over original programming because Netflix is producing two original shows and beat out HBO for House of Cards, the Kevin Spacey, David Fincher project. But even worse, Warner Brothers, because, you know, let's face it, Netflix is going to go to, you know, buy some wholesale stuff you know, those right. DVDs via wholesale. So they're still going to have HBO DVDs. They just won't get them directly from HBO. Now, the worst news for Netflix is that Warner Brothers is rumored to be saying that they are going to delay the release of DVDs to Netflix and Redbox and Blockbuster for 56 days after the DVDs are initially released. That's kind of ridiculous, in my opinion.
Delay them? Who are they giving them to?
Well, to Netflix. They're basically
no,
saying...
No. I mean, are they saying they'll sell them, but you just... I mean, is there anybody else left? I guess Blockbuster, right?
Well, you know, even Blockbuster, they're saying 56 days.
So they're simply not going to make movies available for rental. They're done with the rental business. Is that that's sort of what they're saying? They're creating a new window where they're saying rental will now be 2 months after, you know, you put
after
a movie
sales.
In the theater, you put it out on DVDs first, then 2 months after that, you put it out for rental, and then 6 months after that, you put it on cable, I guess.
That's right. You know,
so this is their idea of a new rental window, and they're going to make it 2 months after a movie is available for sale on DVD. It seems hard to try and stop a film. I mean, they'll just do what they've done before, which is to buy it and rent it.
That's right. They'll buy it through wholesale resources and wholesale distributors instead of buying it directly from the studios. Now, remember last year, they Netflix cut a deal to delay films from Warner Brothers by 28 days. Now, for that, they got more content for their streaming service and also cheaper cost on buying the DVDs directly from Warner Brothers. Well, this time they can't get any of that. So why would they bother cutting this deal? There's no reason to cut this deal.
Well, that means they'll just have to go out alone, right?
Yeah, I mean, anyway. Do we want to cover this whole thing about the actress suing IMDb? I mean, we covered it before. Basically, the actress had to state her name, and she did. It's an actress I haven't heard of, Michael. Have you heard of her?
No, but that doesn't mean anything. But
right, so now the actress suing IMDb because they revealed her age, and she stopped getting roles, supposedly.
Well, she claims.
She claims, yeah. Now we know her name. And in the end, we don't even know who she is. So,
that's a different issue. I mean, working actors and actresses, obviously the less known they are, the more important it is for their age not to be a detriment to their career. When you're not well known, of course, then yeah, you're even more likely to be discriminated against. I mean, Helen Mirren's not going to get discriminated against based on her age. So yeah, the fact that she's not a household name is in fact germane and to more to the point. It supports her case. So the fact that we haven't heard of her doesn't mean that her case has no merit or we don't care what she thinks or says or does. It adds to the validity of her case. She's saying, I'm a working actress. Most people haven't heard of me, but, you know, I get work. I work. I've got credits. And, you know, when they said my age was over 40, suddenly my credits fell apart. So guess what? That's a big problem.
Right. Well, I was talking more about the importance of the news more than the importance of the case itself.
Well, it could be
important, but there's no ruling yet. So
that's why I wouldn't have mentioned the whole thing until the case was dissolved. But I thought you were implying that the fact that we haven't heard of her means who cares about her lack of career?
Oh, no, not at all. No. In other words, should we talk about it at all? I'm going to go with a no, but we kind of already blew that. So, hey, but you know what? That's a perfect segue.
She has 90 credits as an actress, by the way.
Okay.
So, you know, come on.
Well,
not exactly a nobody.
Well, you know, it is a little insidery, so I thought it was a good way to segue into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business, and more importantly, how they will affect you. Now, I guess this week's news really is Inside Baseball, and I don't know if they're going to affect our listeners all that much. Maybe for some fans of Disney films, but you might recall, a while back, we mentioned that Disney had, you know, had a new chairman, Rich Ross, who came over from the Disney Channel, and Bob Iger installed him into, you know, the chairmanship of the studio. And he kind of did something very interesting and very what we thought was unique. He hired M.T. Carney to be the head of marketing, and she came out of an advertising background. She was basically ran an advertising agency for packaged goods, so she had no film experience at all. Well, it turns out, you know, from April 2010 to today, it looks like she's going to be leaving the studio after, you know, 18 months.
No. What is she out officially?
Well, you know, everybody's reporting it as if she is out. I mean, and everybody, the Hollywood Reporter, the New York Times, Brooks Barnes over at the New York Times ran this piece on Sunday, and then everybody else picked up on it and started to confirm it through various channels.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what did you read this piece?
No, I didn't. I mean, I skimmed it, yes.
I mean, I thought there were some things, you know, it starts off with her visiting the set of War Horse where all of her colleagues were wearing, you know, jeans and dirty shoes because you're visiting a set. The set is for a horse film. And it's in a rural area, so it's probably going to be quite dirty and there's going to be manure lying around. She shows up wearing white pants and Chanel flats. And I thought, okay, so you're trying to show that she's a, you know, fish out of water and that, you know, but she was new on the job. That was her first 3 months. And even having successes like the Muppets and the Help, it just didn't save her.
There's two stories here. The other one is about Dawn Hudson, who's the head of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. She's the chief executive. And the two articles seem very similar to me. We have women coming into a new position, and they're abrasive, they're tough, they ruffle feathers. People who've been doing their jobs the same way for many years don't like the fact that these newcomers have come in and want to do things a new way. And they're being kicked out, or they're being threatened with being kicked out. If you want to read it from a gender angle, it seems like they're just strong executives who may make some mistakes, may do some good things, may do some bad things. But the fact that they're ruffling feathers, pushing people around, want to do it their own way, bring in their own people, you know, it sounds like every other damn executive I've ever heard of in Hollywood. I don't know why they're losing their jobs. I look at M.T. Carney's track record, and The Help is a very difficult film to promote. You have The Help. You have, Real Steel did not click. The Muppets did click. You know, she has a pretty good list of movies that she made happen. War Horse is not tearing it up, but it's got decent word of mouth. It was, you know, they've been tweaking the campaign and they're working along. Let's see how it, you know, ends up. If she has a good, you know, relationship with Spielberg, then great. You
well,
know.
She didn't. I mean, not that she had a bad one, but certainly one executive said, do you really think Steven Spielberg is going to put the marketing of his film in M.T. Carney's hands? She has no experience. And I thought,
Spielberg, I'm sure, has a strong hand in all the marketing of every film he does at every studio, but he did not work with her. There's no story about him rejecting her or not talking to her or not being happy with what she did.
No, I agree with you. I'm in total agreement. I thought that was all hearsay. And I guess, you know, what rankles me, and I understand that, you know, for The Sorcerer's Apprentice, you know, she approved the tagline, "It's the coolest job ever." And everybody laughed and thought it was a horrible tagline. And so be it. But you know what? It was a horrible film. So
yeah, exactly.
There was, you know, no tagline tanked that film or torpedoed that film. You know, when it comes to M.T. Carney, I will say this. I was a little disgruntled, if you will, I guess maybe is a good word, because I look at this industry, I look at Hollywood, and I say, this is a town and this is an industry that loves to lionize people who do things differently and succeed. People like Steve Jobs. You know, think different. Oh, we should all be thinking different and trying to come up with unique and original ideas. But the second somebody tries to do that, somebody like Rich Ross or Bob Iger, in this case, bringing M.T. Carney in, and possibly even M.T. Carney for you know, maybe taking a different approach to marketing, the second somebody actually tries to do that, they try and squash it. So it's very hypocritical, and it just kind of bugs me a little bit.
Right. I felt the same way. And I'm not quite sure what her new crazy marketing plans were.
I don't think there were any crazy marketing plans. I think that, you know, when somebody comes in from the outside world and ruffles feathers, people turn on them.
Right. I mean, so how is she supposed to be innovative or different? Is it simply because she didn't come from a film background?
I guess so. Yes.
Right. And the same thing seems to be true of Dawn Hudson. She was the head of the Independent Film Project, right?
Which is now Film Independent, the Independent Spirit Awards, as you just said. And she was hired as the CEO or the chairman?
Chief executive
of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, the folks who do the Oscars. So here the indie world kind of coming into being legitimized by hiring the person who's running the Independent Spirit Awards.
Right, and the same story seems to be being told here. I feel like we're a Gloria Steinem this week, you know, that she came in and she didn't meet with everybody properly, and people who, you know, were unhappy that she was trying to do things new ways, and she was making changes right away and suggesting things, even though she didn't really understand how things worked. You know, how dare she have new ideas and shake things up when she's just arrived on the job, you know?
Well, I think there were some
very similar in a way, but yeah, there were some very negative things. Like she's saying, I want $4 million. You know, somebody claims at the end of a meeting, she tossed in, oh, I want $4 million to redo these offices. You know, as if she expected him to say, oh, sure, have your $4 million. And she said it's to improve office communication. And someone said, well, try talking to your staff first.
Yeah, try that to improve communication. Yeah, I mean, I guess, there were some very negative things in this article. And she was hired under a 3-year contract. And there's already talk of, you know, how they can buy out her contract.
Well, a minority on the board that it does not have the majority of the board's support. The majority of the board is with her, but a minority said, can we buy her? You know, some people are unhappy with her, not a significant enough to threaten her job at this stage.
Right. And I guess she came in and there was some working group, and Andrew Marlowe, the screenwriter who wrote Seven and others, tossed him aside. And he was just like, you know, I don't know what I did wrong. She was on the phone for half an hour with me, and all of a sudden I was no longer working on that work, you know, in that group. I don't get it. So she definitely has ruffled some feathers,
when she was also unhappy, they were also sort of worried about the Oscars, because that's where they get all their funding from. And they had Brian Grazer, and I mean, they had, you know, what's his name, Brett Ratner and Eddie Murphy, and that fell apart, blew up in their face. So I wouldn't blame her for that. And they went and got Brian Grazer and Billy Crystal. Sounds as safe a, you know, fallback position as you could ask for.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look at the Oscars. Look at the Golden Globes. You want something different. You want something that might be a little edgy or unique. So you hire Ricky Gervais.
I don't know if you want edgy for the Oscars.
Well, not the Oscars, the Golden Globes.
Well, she's not in charge of that.
Well, I'm using both of them as an example. You hire Ricky Gervais for the Golden Globes, and he gives you exactly what he's paid to do. That, I mean, he gives you Ricky Gervais. Brett Ratner, you kind of knew was a loose cannon. You hire him, and he's a loose cannon. And you know what? You wanted something different. You got something different, but you didn't really want something different.
Well, that would be a criticism of her then. She started in April. She signed off on Brett Ratner.
Well, no, what I'm saying is it's a criticism really of the whole town, and the way it works is they say they want something different and something unique, but in the end, they make sequels.
Mm-hmm. Well, my whole point is just simply let's judge the track record of what they've actually done rather than these stories about how rude they are to people and they didn't wear the right pair of pants to this film set. You know, let's
I totally
see what
agree with
Edgar Carr's marketing record is. Doesn't look that bad. If there's a botched film, maybe it's real steel, though I don't frankly think that they had high hopes for that. You know, as I look at Disney's movies for the year that she probably had a hand in. That's probably one she had a hand in that didn't maybe left some money on the table, I guess, but not by much.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I hope she stays on.
Yeah, well, we'll have to see. Well, she sounds like she's gone.
Yeah,
MG
I would agree with
Carney.
You.
But Dawn Hudson will have a little chance to prove herself.
She's not going to prove herself this week. And speaking of which, we're not going to continue talking about news this week, but we will be back next week. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or on Stitcher. You can also rate and review the show there. Please do, because that does help us out. You can follow us on Twitter. Showbiz Sandbox is our username. You can like us on Facebook. Again, Showbiz Sandbox is our username. And you can find all of these links as well as ways to contact us. You can email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com, and that's also where you'll find links to all of the stories we've talked about on today's episode. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz, entertainment journalist extraordinaire, he has a website. Michael, why don't you tell everybody what it is?
It's michaelgiltz.com. That's right.
Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. And until next week, play nice.